Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 23rd of February. This hour of the program, we're going to be talking about religion and what role it should play in political discourse. There's been a lot of talk about religion in the presidential campaign. As you well know, last night during the Republican debate, the last of those debates, Newt Gingrich talked about Obama's recent decision mandating that employers' insurance plans cover contraception by pointing out that Obama voted in favor of a law that protected abortion providers during his term as state senator of Illinois. In a statement directed to Mitt Romney, he said, "You did not once during the 2008 campaign ask why Barack Obama voted in favor of legalizing infanticide." Mitt Romney said, "I don't think we've seen in the history of this country the kind of attack on religious freedom that we've seen in Barack Obama, most recently requiring the Catholic Church to provide for its employees and its various enterprises health care insurance that would include birth control, sterilization, and the morning after pill." The Reverend Franklin Graham appeared on MSNBC and created quite a stir by saying under President Obama, the Muslims of the world, he seems more concerned about them than the Christians being murdered in the Muslim countries. He praised former Egyptian dictator Mubarak for protecting the rights of Christian people. And he said that he thinks that Newt Gingrich is a Christian. He told him that he was. He said about Mitt Romney, when asked if he's a Christian, he's a Mormon. Most Christians would not recognize Mormons as part of the Christian faith. And when it came to the faith of the president, he said that he could not rule out the possibility that Obama may secretly be a Muslim, because Islam has gotten a free pass under Obama. Joining us to analyze those comments and more, Professor Kevin Dendulk is our guest, professor in the Department of Political Science at Grand Valley State University, teacher scholar in residence during this academic year at Calvin College. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I think we'll have a few this hour on this topic. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Professor Dendulk, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Kathleen.
I can't remember too many other presidential races in which religion has been talked about so frequently, and specifically whether or not somebody is a Christian, how big a Christian they are, whether or not Mormonism is Christianity. It just is this something that should be discussed in a presidential campaign, and why is it being so discussed?
Oh, well, those are two very big questions, whether we should and why. Maybe I'll start with the why. And in fact, we can go back in history. You set up the question by wondering, you know, is this something that is new, at least the intensity of it? But of course, historically in the United States, in presidential campaigns and in other election campaigns, we've seen all sorts of examples where the religion, the religious identity of the candidates has figured prominently in the campaign, even before we had mass media. I mean, we could go back to the second presidential election and look at the kind of sometimes scurrilous attacks that were made against Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. And we go through history and see lots of other examples of that. It is important in part because if I were to kind of make a big picture explanation for why it's so important, it's important in part because religion is important to people's identities. It's a way that they define themselves and a way that they define how they ought to relate to other people. And so it would make sense to some extent that we would have debates about the religiosity of our leaders. And so that's one reason we're seeing it. In this particular election, I'd say that it's become important for lots of reasons. One is that the religious identity of the candidates, especially on the Republican side, is unconventional in a sense. You know, historically, candidates have come from one of the Protestant traditions, But in this instance, with the exception of Ron Paul, all three candidates are not, on the Republican side, are not from Protestant traditions. You have Santorum and Gingrich, both Catholics, and of course Romney as a Mormon, and that has raised some questions. You get a sense that these candidates are trying to show that they are mainstream and safe in their religious identity. I think it also matters because it is a Republican primary, and over the last 30 years, we've seen a change in the sense that religious traditionalists have become so crucially important as a base of support within the Republican Party. And so these three candidates, or four candidates, really have to speak to that base. So there's a lot of factors going on there. Those are a few reasons why I think this is coming up. This should, should it be a part of the debate? You know, in some ways, we don't like it to be a part of the debate because it's, you know, combining the two of the things that we're never really supposed to talk about,
right,
like company, right? And
right,
we say that because, you know, it might lead to conflict, and it does lead to conflict. And so that's one reason why we might say it shouldn't be a part of the debate. But again, you know, given the fact that it is such an authentic part of people's identity, it stands to reason that they're going to want to know about this.
And yet I remember when we had a huge debate about religion and President, then candidate John Kennedy had to put the issue to rest by assuring the American people really that the Pope wasn't going to govern the United States. It seems as though we're at another extreme now where people are touting their Catholicism and their faith. Isn't there a concern about whether or not the church would be running the country this go around?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting if you contrast how JFK spoke about his own Catholicism and his relationship to the church, and how that might, or in the way he talked about, of course, how it would not affect his decision making. If you contrast that with a speech that Mitt Romney gave during the last presidential election, where he made a similar kind of argument as JFK, in the sense of suggesting that the Mormon Church wouldn't call the shots for him. But then he took another step and said, still, my religious faith is crucially important to the way I think and the way I look at the world and the kinds of decisions that I make. And, you know, in a sense, he felt compelled to say, yes, it is true that the church won't call the shots, yet religion still matters to me. And I think that reflects an understanding of a separation of church and state, where he was trying to suggest, look, there's a difference between religious institutions calling the shots and me saying, look, I've got a religious identity and it matters to the way I think. That's the line I think all these candidates are trying to draw. And in that sense, you know, they would all, I think, respond to you by saying, no, the church wouldn't call the shots, yet my religious faith does matter to the way I think.
Let's talk, because I thought that these comments were unbelievable. Reverend Franklin Graham's comments about Newt Gingrich and Santorum, both of whom he said were Christian because they had told him so. Then we get to the president, and he says, well, I can't answer that question for anybody, but Islam sees him as a son of Islam because his father was a Muslim, his grandfather was a Muslim, great-grandfather, and so under Islamic law, the Muslim world sees Barack Obama as a Muslim, which isn't true. And then he says, I can't say categorically that Obama is not a Muslim because Islam has gotten a free pass under Obama. What about those comments?
Oh, mercy. Well, I think, first of all, that, there is a sizable percentage. I'm a political scientist, so let me put it in political terms. There's a sizable percentage of religious believers out there, many of whom are traditionalist evangelicals, but certainly not all evangelicals, but a sizable percentage who will say things that are similar to Franklin Graham in terms of what they think the president's own religious identity is. And to be very clear, the president is a Christian. And so he, you know, so when Graham says that, in some ways he's reflecting what this population tends to think about the president, and you know, this argument that he's in some ways a closet a Muslim, and that means he's sympathetic to the Muslim world. And so, you know, that fits within a kind of a category of the population right now. I would also say, though, that we, you know, there's a tendency to go to people like Franklin Graham to get that kind of quote. But the influence of someone like Graham may be a little bit less than sometimes we think. And in fact, from my perspective, I think many of those more conservative evangelical leaders who may have had a significant amount of influence, especially in the 1980s and particularly in the 90s, that kind of influence is waning. We still go to them to get these kinds of quotes from time to time, and that stirs up some controversy. But I think we can overstate the influence of someone like Franklin Graham on these matters. But it is interesting, and from a political perspective, though, that population that wonders about, to put it charitably, the president's own religious identity, really is already sort of locked up on the Republican side anyway. So it's not going to have much of an effect. They're not. Franklin Graham's comments aren't really going to change anyone's mind at this point in the game.
Mm-hmm. The other issue that, of course, has been front and center for a few weeks now, and Romney mentioned this again last night in the debate, I don't think we've seen in the history of this country the kind of attack on religious freedom we've seen in Barack Obama, and most recently requiring the Catholic Church to provide for its employees and its various enterprises health care insurance that would include birth control, sterilization, and the morning after pill. This certainly has been a theme among, except for Ron Paul, all of the presidential candidates, and created quite a stir. Was the president insensitive to religious issues here?
I would say yes. In fact, he in issuing that ruling through the HHS, there was some insensitivity to the understandings, particularly of Catholics, about contraception. You know, whatever we all might think about contraception and access to contraception, you still have to keep in mind that there are some religious groups that are opposed, and so there's this question, a real religious freedom question, about the status of the Catholic Church here and whether there was a violation of its own religious freedom by essentially forcing it to pay for contraception. At least that was the original ruling, and there's been some effort at compromise since that's not satisfying everybody, but there's been some effort there. So, yeah, I would say there's some insensitivity there. The comment, though, I think I think it's interesting that comment that Romney made about there never having been, an administration that's, I forget the exact quote, but has been as insensitive or dangerous even to religious freedom. There's some almost irony in that statement, in the sense that, as a Mormon, one would think he'd have a historical memory of a church that is among the most persecuted of churches.
Yes.
By the government in the history of the U.S. So there was some hyperbole there, no doubt.
Let's go to phone calls. Our lines are filled. Our number is 800-486-8655, and we've only just touched the surface of the role that religion is playing in political discourse now and what role it should play. Our guest is Professor Kevin Dendulk, professor in the Department of Political Science at Grand Valley State University and scholar in residence during this academic year at Calvin College. 800-486-8655. The number, the email is talk. talk at WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour two of our program, a show for all nonconformists, the author of Beautiful Souls, Saying No, Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times. We go to phone calls. Let's go to Peter in Baraboo first. Hi, Peter.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking the call, Kathleen, and thank you again for another great show. I am a school board member up here in Baraboo, and I believe it's terribly important as we try to do in our educational arena to help young people understand the difference between institutionalized thinking, which tends to be limiting, and what we strive for, which is something much larger, which I would make the distinction between religion and spirit. You know, our great American writers of the ilk of Emerson, Whitman, and Thoreau have always taught us to be more open-minded when it comes to sensing spirit and being guided. So I'd like to make that point about religion tending to be more institutionalized and limiting in thinking versus spirit. It's interesting how that plays itself out in our history over and over again, as your guest has indicated. There's nothing new about attempting to divide and conquer, to find limiting individual issues that can divide people and use that as a basis for moving forward. It's interesting to me at the same time that we're trying to teach civility and open-mindedness to our young people to help bridge this gap, while in the culture, and particularly in politics, we have not yet transformed ourselves or overcome those very limited ways of thinking. And to conclude, just my heart breaks for President Obama. You know, he's damned if he does and damned if he doesn't. As someone who comes from much larger background of the black church tradition, you know, he was hung for being associated with Jeremiah Wright earlier on, and now, of course, being hung for a history of more openness in terms of religion and his background, which is much more open than limiting.
Mm. Thank you so much. Very interesting points.
Thank you so much for the show. I think it's terribly important to keep reminding people.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Peter. Professor?
Yeah, well, a couple of things. First of all, of course, religion is one of the most useful ways for candidates to organize people and to mobilize people. And in that mobilization, that does mean that candidates will use it as an opportunity also to divide, to make distinctions. It's easier to organize and mobilize when you can come up with discrete groups of people. And so the political uses of religion can be divisive that way, especially when we see it in campaigns. But I'd also like to just give maybe a somewhat more charitable or the other side of how organized religion sometimes operates, and perhaps to use President Obama as an example. You know, just as religion can divide, especially when it's used politically, it's often been a way of bringing people together, including organized religion. And so when you look at President Obama's own background, using the Catholic Church and the African American Church in Chicago as a way of organizing communities when he was working there. This is a rich tradition in the United States of using religion in that way for good social purposes. And so, you know, religion can be used in lots of different ways for good and ill. But I think your caller certainly, in terms of its political uses, has put his finger on one of the deep and abiding problems that we see with its political uses.
Well, I think his comment that we're trying to teach our children tolerance and a respect for all religions, Muslim, Jewish faith, Catholicism, Mormonism, that should be something. We live in America, for heaven's sake.
Yeah.
And so that's a very important thing. And to have the rhetoric be how Catholic you are, or
right.
it seems to be problematic in terms of being tolerant.
Yeah, it's especially in schools, in thinking about how we teach religion and try to understand religion and religious differences in schools. That's a really difficult challenge. How to do that? Of course, we want. It seems to me we'd want our kids to understand different kinds of religious ideas and so forth, in part because through that understanding, they may become more tolerant of those other ideas. How to do that without, this concern that our public institutions are sympathetic to one particular religious idea or another has been, as I say, a very difficult challenge. But it's, again, seems to me a very important part of what our educational system ought to be doing.
Ronald in Wauwatosa. Hi, Ronald.
Hi, good morning, Kathleen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a retired Lutheran minister. Oh. I don't know if that puts me in the category of the evangelicals, but I know my own faith tradition can be very conservative. But I don't know that I've seen a situation that is so appalling to me in the sense that these candidates who tout their own religiosity are so forgetful of one criterion of it, and that is not to bear false witness against one's neighbor. Then it depends on how you number the commandments. It's either the eighth or the ninth. How not to bear false witness against thy neighbor. And I charge all of these candidates and Franklin Graham with that very charge. They are libeling and defaming our president, and it's appalling to me that they call themselves Christians.
Professor Dendulk.
Oh, well, ditto. Politics and these kinds of campaigns, and especially this one where it's gone on for a long time and the candidates have gotten to a point where the focus is both on each other now and on the president, it's brought out some instances where clearly the candidates have said some things about the president that in some cases aren't even true. And so I was thinking as he was talking about how a social observer, Alexis de Tocqueville, back in the 1830s, said that the power of religion is strongest when it's seen as least political, when leaders kind of stand aloof, stand apart from politics, when they represent ideas, including, not bearing false witness and so forth. They represent those ideas, but they're not involved directly in the political process. What we're seeing, of course, here is candidates who are talking explicitly about their religion, but they're right in the thick of the, push and pull of politics, and that elicits the kinds of reactions that we just heard.
Thank you, Ronald, for the call. Can you give us a little bit of a background? You mentioned Jefferson and Adams earlier on, the kind of attacks they faced, religious attacks?
Yeah, well, Jefferson in particular was accused of all sorts of things, being an infidel and so forth. Jefferson in particular, I would argue, was a deist, but still referred to himself as a Christian, looked at the Bible, looked at Jesus' teachings as good moral instruction, good moral teachings, but wanted to strip away what he perceived as the more superstitious or supernatural elements of it, and that led to these accusations that in fact he wasn't sufficiently or mainstream enough, maybe that's the way we'd put it today, of a Christian. And he wasn't, that was certainly part of that election. We've seen other instances over the years where presidential candidates have been accused of similar things, of, in a sense, being out of the mainstream. Lincoln, there were some accusations against Lincoln along those lines. If you go into the 20th century, we start to see candidates, especially on the Democratic side, who are coming from, at least at the time, unconventional or minority or from some people's perspective, out of the mainstream religious groups. So Al Smith in 1928 is a Catholic nominee for the Democratic Party. Of course, JFK, as we've already mentioned. And even into the into more modern, the modern presidential election cycles, John Kerry and so forth, although it was a little bit less of a concern because Catholics were largely perceived as having come into the mainstream. Today, you know, Romney is really the clearest example of somebody who, for some people, is perceived as out of the mainstream. And it really reflects a kind of pattern in American politics and the way people understand the religious identity of presidents. The way I presidential candidates. The way I typically put this is that if you want to be a candidate, you have to at least be able to show that you're religious. From a religious perspective, the worst thing you can do as a candidate is to come out as an atheist. And we see that in polling data over and over again, that, you know, you have to have some claim to religiosity. But after that, there's a hierarchy of religious preferences in the American public. And so you can go up the hierarchy. So if you say, well, I'm religious, but I'm Muslim, that's going to make it more difficult for you. And the hierarchy goes up. Well, the next religious group in that hierarchy, if we just look at polling data here, are Mormons. So it goes essentially atheists, Muslims, Mormons, Jews, evangelical Protestants, and Catholics. That's the way it looks today in terms of that kind of hierarchy of religious preferences.
Do you think it would behoove Romney, because his religion is obviously very important to him,
yeah,
he skirted around it. We don't know a whole lot about Mormonism. Should he talk about it?
Yeah, that's a great question, a great kind of strategic question for him. The way he has been handling religion, this is just my kind of impression of this campaign, is a little bit different than what he did last time around. In 2008, he was explicit in that speech that he gave. He tackled it straight on. This time around, he'll say things such as, you know, religion is very important to me, but he won't name the religion. He won't talk about it, you know, explicitly that way. And it is an interesting question if he were to attack it straight on again and say, you know, this is my faith, this is what it means in general, this is what it means to me, this is what it won't mean if I were elected president. So he could talk about it openly again, and I think it would help him. I don't think he could, I don't think he should assume that people would remember a speech that he gave in 2007 on the matter. But on the other hand, there's, I think, an open question about whether his religious faith in the election right now is really hurting him as much as other kinds of factors. You know, a lack of enthusiasm in the way he presents himself, or about his conservatism. You know, that disentangling what is, you know, what is the average Republican voter's concern about religion versus what is the average Republican primary voter's concern about his conservatism? It's a hard thing to do. So, so the strategic choice is a difficult one. If he talks about it openly, then it becomes a subject of conversation, and maybe that's a good thing. But it's only a good thing if it really matters to the way the average Republican voter is thinking about voting right now, and it may not.
Dan in Three Lakes, hi.
Good morning. Couple of quick points. The country was only less than or just over 20 years old when the Marine Corps hymn referred to the shores of Tripoli because the Marines were sent to rescue Christian missionaries from the Muslims over there. And I don't know anybody in this country that's ever had a Muslim knocking on his door trying to convert them to Muslimism or Islamism. And the notion that birth control is a miracle ordained and controlled by God is really ridiculous. Any gynecologist will tell you that one half of all fertilized eggs that happen of normal heterosexual relations are flushed right through the woman's system without ever implanting in the womb. Another 15% that do of the eggs, that the ones that do implant in the womb, undergo what doctors call spontaneous abortion and laymen call miscarriages. And so if God's in charge, his track record is not good. And I believe the notion is bunk. And another thing that was pointed out in the paper just the other day, in earlier times, and I recall this because my paternal grandmother had 12 kids, and every one of them was born in either October or November. At earlier times, when women had lots of children and nursed them, breastfed them, they didn't have periods for a year or two. They didn't have menstrual cycles. And so in their entire childbearing lifetime, they may have only had 30 menstrual cycles, whereas now with women having fewer children, if they don't have as many children and don't breastfeed, they may have 300 menstrual cycles, with which comes substantial increases in female health problems.
All right. Thank you, Dan, very much for your call. Let's go to an email that's come in from Sean in Green Bay. Religion has no place in modern politics. Church and state should be clearly separated. Mythological beliefs, regardless of what they are, simply cloud judgment of good leadership. We should be supporting candidates who will make the most productive decisions for our entire society.
Yeah, well, let me, actually, I think I'm able, even though I'm not going to at all touch biology, political scientist here, but, you know, I actually can, I think, weave together both of these comments, because, you know, the question, let's just use the example of the recent controversy over the HHS directive on contraception. Whatever you might think about the biology, the question isn't really about whether birth control is ought to be a matter of religious concern. The question is, if it is a matter of religious concern, is there a religious freedom grounds for saying that the Catholic Church or any other religious institution or group of persons ought to be protected under the Constitution? And so, you know, this kind of gets to the emailer's comment as well. The idea of a strict separation between church and state is crucially important in our history, and it usually focuses on ensuring that there is a separation between institutions of religion and the state. That doesn't necessarily mean that there is a separation of religion and politics, but the idea is that if we can keep this separation between religious institutions, and if we can maintain that separation, we protect the religious freedom of everyone, including folks who don't want anything to do with religion. And so, you know, the way I'd like to always frame the question is not so much in terms of whether I agree or disagree with someone's religious beliefs, but whether I agree or disagree with whether they ought to be free to have them. And so, you know, in both of the comments we just heard, that would be the way I'd try to frame the debate.
Let's go next to Where are we? Let's go to Kate in Eau Claire. Hi, Kate.
Hi, how are you?
All right, Kate, how are you?
Great. I'm calling because, well, first I heard one of the commenters mention that they've yet to see a Muslim knock on their door and try to convert them. And that's because Islam does not believe in proselytization. Folks in Islam will not do that. They want people to make that choice to convert on their own. And I'm not Muslim, actually. I'm a Gen Xer, and that's how I identify. And I prefer, and I've been raised in a time of cultural and religious pluralism and a certain acceptance. And so in my identity, I don't want to see this kind of promotion of religious ideals with among these different politicians, because I feel it is divisive and it causes more problems. I'd rather know what their moral stance is. Finally, as a university educator, I deal with these young people who come in who are very closed-minded evangelicals at this point, and it scares me because they're not open to all other different religious and cultural possibilities within our country, and it makes me feel like we're going backward. That's all I have to say, and I'll take the comments.
Thanks,
there.
Kate.
Thanks
for the call.
You know, one thing in response to the caller, one of the really interesting things for political scientists and for other political observers right now are people who say, look, I have a spiritual life. I maybe believe in a God. I'm kind of eclectic in the religious practices that I have, but I don't really want a connection to, at least a strong connection to organized religion, the so-called spiritual but not religious. And that tends to be characteristic of younger people, to some extent Gen Xers. And what we're trying to understand, I think, as social scientists right now, is what are the political implications of the fact that a lot of folks are disengaging, unaffiliating from religious traditions and moving into this idea of being spiritual but not religious. Which, you know, isn't a, you know, being spiritual but not religious is not an argument that, look, we don't have a set of moral beliefs or something along those lines. It's just to say there's a disaffiliating and there's a lot of political implications to that. There was also the comment about evangelical students coming into the university being closed-minded. I guess I'd only caution that when we look at evangelicalism as a group, it isn't monolithic. There's a lot of diversity within it. You know, that closed-mindedness can happen in lots of different places as well. I get a little bit concerned about the language in the presidential election about evangelicals as if they're a monolithic group. We certainly saw that in some of the earlier states, South Carolina and so forth. I kept hearing the discussion about evangelicals and the evangelical vote. And it's not quite as monolithic when we look at the data as it might seem.
I sometimes wonder, and you're a political scientist, so tell me what the strategy must be of many of the Republican candidates right now, that it wasn't that long ago, things moved pretty rapidly, that the focus was on jobs, the economy, the deficit. And now we're talking about birth control. And
yeah.
I'm sorry, most people in this country use birth control, no matter
right.
what their religion is. It seems to me to be an issue that's kind of off base for everybody. Why is there so much talk about it? Who do the Republicans think they're going to attract by having this huge conversation about something that everybody uses?
Yeah. Well, you know, we're in a primary, and in a primary election, the electorate looks a lot different than the general electorate. Mm. And so I suspect, you know, the Republican who wins in this campaign is going to go right back to the economy when it comes to the general election. Right now, though, you know, I'm in Michigan. Well, in Michigan, there is a good proportion of the population in the primary, in the Republican primary here, who are concerned about the so-called social issues. That isn't to say that those voters are necessarily against the use of birth control. Many of those voters are not Catholics who have a particular concern about the use of birth control. But many of those voters will respond to an argument about what this birth control controversy tells us, or what the perception might be about the Obama administration. And so you might have noticed, for example, in the debate last night, the debaters were fairly careful, not always, but fairly careful about saying, look, the problem is that the Obama administration is violating religious freedom, right, or, you know, abusing religion, rather than just framing it in terms of birth control. Well, that strategy may play well for some Republican primary voters who are concerned about social issues and the status of religion. Again, that's different than just a discussion about birth control. So at least, that, you know, if I were to sort of give a generous interpretation to what the strategy must be among some in these Republican camps right now, that's how I would look at it.
More phone calls in a moment. Religion and politics. This hour of the program, our guest is Professor Kevin Dendulk, professor in the Department of Political Science at Grand Valley State University, and he is teacher scholar in residence at Calvin College. Our phone number, one line, is open now, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our next caller is Bill in Madison.
Hello.
Hi.
Let me turn off my speakerphone here. Am I on now?
Yes, you are.
Oh, I'm sorry. Something Rick Santorum said earlier this week I found very disturbing, and I have not heard hardly anyone talk about this in the media. I'm really surprised this hasn't been red flagged more. He said, and I'm going to paraphrase here, he says, liberty is not the freedom to do what you want to do. It's the freedom to do what you ought to do. And, of course, the implication is if you just elect me president, I'm just the guy to tell you what you ought to do. And as a Roman Catholic, person who grew up Roman Catholic, I know enough about Roman Catholic history that there's been a lot of moral reasoning is a legitimate discipline within the Roman Catholic Church. St. Thomas Aquinas, St. Thomas More, John Milton, St. Augustine, all wrote, you know, brilliantly reasoned moral philosophy tracts. And the thing was, though, in the Roman Catholic Church, they also have a tradition of they see moral reasoning as something that is left with the professionals. In other words, let the theologians decide what is right and wrong and why. And we're going to stand up in our pulpits and we're going to tell you. You know, the layman, what our teachings are and what's right and what's wrong, and you're supposed to obey if you're a good Catholic. And that in America, it just seems that Santorum is so anti-American, un-American, anti-democratic. This notion that he has a monopoly on what's right and wrong, and he's basically going to tell us if he and as president, he feels it's his job to instruct us.
All right, Professor.
Yeah, I think that in that comment, he's really making an old distinction between what political theorists sometimes refer to as negative freedom versus positive freedom. That negative freedom is to be free from something, including the constraints of government. And positive freedom is to be free to be a certain kind of person, I guess I'll put it that way. Now, one, you know, I think actually Santorum has received a little bit of blowback as a result of that and some other comments along those lines. And he has kind of responded by saying, well, it's one thing for me to make this kind of distinction about freedom and to suggest almost as if I'm behind the bully pulpit, so to speak, that we ought to think about freedom in a different way. It's a very different thing to say that I'm going to use government to try to impose that. And so he did make that distinction. I think, I don't know if it was in the actual debate or if it was in a speech beforehand, where he said, you know, I'm not necessarily suggesting that I would use government to impose this kind of understanding of freedom on people. You saw that in the debate last night when the candidates started to get into these questions about out-of-wedlock births, right, and other kinds of cultural issues. They weren't necessarily suggesting policy. Maybe they have some policies in mind to address that, but they were trying to suggest, hey, look, we ought to have a cultural conversation around, about this. And so, you know, that may be one sort of distinction that Santorum would want to make. I might think about freedom this way, but that doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to use government to impose it. Now, the caller and everyone else, you know, may be suspicious about that, right? But it's a distinction that Santorum was trying to make.
Thanks, Bill, for the call. Tim in Eau Claire, hi.
Thanks for taking my call. I'm going to be the one dissenting vote here. I'm an evangelical conservative pastor. I'm very political, and I'm very biblically oriented. I keep hearing people use terms that are very, really modern type of terms like tolerance, and we should be open. And this entire notion that religion has no place in politics is really a modern myth. Religion was very instrumental in the founding of our country. It's always been very much part of our country. Really, the problem I see is that you have a country that has been framed in a lot of secular terminology and understanding, and they're really not familiar with the convictions of people with deep-held religious beliefs. For instance, I'm glad that we're finally talking about some moral issues, because I think these are things that are important. One of the things, for instance, a couple of your guests called in and said, well, we should be more open and tolerant. The entire notion is that, well, somehow those with traditional religious convictions really don't have a place in the public arena. You know, it's okay to be a Christian, just keep it in your church. But the fact of the matter is, tolerance and this idea of openness is really just secular catchphrases for whatever you want to believe, that's just fine, it never should be questioned. But that's just not reality.
Well, how do you deal with the fact that we are a nation of so many different religious beliefs? How do you make sure that everybody's sensitivities are taken into account?
Well, the fact of the matter is, number one, we have to stop this notion that religion is bad. That is a constant secularist idea that's been perpetrated upon us, that, you know, religion is bad, we shouldn't have it involved in politics. Well, everybody governs from a moral perspective. And there are certain morals and absolutes that our nation was founded upon that we really shouldn't run from. We should say, well, what about this issue? We should have open and debates about these issues, but we're not.
Hello? Okay, we lost you somehow. I didn't cut you off. We lost you. I don't know where you are. We have something wrong with your phone here.
With my phone?
Yeah. Professor, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Yeah, we're going to have to call you right back. I'm sorry, because it's just... Hello? No, we'll call him right back. There's a big echo there. So I'm sure that he heard those comments, and we will respond to them if we can. And let's go to Connie in Madison. Our guest probably can't hear you, Connie, but we can. Go
That's
ahead.
All right. Okay. I'm actually glad to follow this previous caller. During the wars following the Protestant Reformation, Europe saw some of the most fantastically bloody wars over exactly theological issues. They were, of course, partly political wars, but there were persecutions and there were many deaths, and it was a terribly bloody period. And so Europe burst the capacity to create a secular sphere and to make room for pluralism, which I think is one of the great accomplishments, given that we had first the printing press and now the internet, to be able to, first of all, put up with what I'd call the other. But I think tolerance is a very fragile thing, because when one is threatened, the other becomes the easy scapegoat. So tolerance becomes more robust when we have a deep and abiding real curiosity during calm times about the other. And that curiosity can lead to more literacy and more personal relationships, which allows us the integrity of our own faith stories. I happen to be a Christian, and I have a deep and abiding trust in the sturdiness of my own faith story and my understanding of the sacredness of the human person. And I do not feel personally threatened whatsoever by a Jewish person's understanding. In fact, I benefit from it. I'm an inheritor of that tradition. And the more I learn about Islam, which I came to through art history many, many years ago, but I deeply am glad to have now become much more literate since 9/11. My curiosity exploded, and I have many more personal relationships now. So I'd like to hear a little bit about tolerance leading to something more than just putting up with the other.
Thank you, Connie, very much for the call, and we'll have to just say that we will hear about that on a later show. We're plumb out of time. Professor Dendulk, thank you very much. I don't know what happened to the phone, but...
No, sorry about that. I don't either.
Thank you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Yeah, you bet. It's my pleasure.
Professor in the Department of Political Science at Grand Valley State University and teacher in residence at Calvin College. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee.